it is a place where we can turn to share our thoughts. That's Bob Marley and the Wailers, in case you needed to know, with I Know a Place. It's our weekly referendum on the system. It's called Free Your Mind Friday. And listeners analyze and deconstruct what the system has been up to and still is up to. And it's an open forum for the exchange of information, opinions, and ideas in the midst of the national selections for president. I'm sure the shenanigans of the duopoly may take center stage, but there are no rules. You may opine on whatever subject you wish. Call 888-874-4888, and let's have you cast your vote in this open referendum on the system. Well, we have several takers already, and we'll start with Joel from New York. Hello, Joel.
Hi, Idris. I hope you've had a very good week.
I certainly have, and I'm grateful for it. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for asking. I'd just like to talk a little briefly about Chairman Bernie's Iraq war hypocrisy, if I may.
Sure.
And Sanders has been tagging Hillary Clinton, also known as Lady Macbeth, for her 2002 vote in support of Bush's war against Saddam Hussein. And here, Sanders is closely following Obama's 2008 playbook, where Obama used the Iraq War, if you remember, used the Iraq War vote to repeatedly knock Clinton off balance. But Sanders' shots at Clinton haven't inflicted that much damage this time around, I think, largely because there's so little breathing space between the two candidates on foreign policy. In fact, both Clinton and Sanders are seasoned interventionists and often advance their hawkish policies under the banner of humanitarianism. This, by the way, is the major theme of a book that I mentioned last week, a brilliant short biography of Hillary by Diana Johnstone called Queen of Chaos. And Sanders, back in 98, supported Clinton's war in Serbia. He voted for the 2001 authorization for unilateral military force against terrorists, which pretty much allowed Bush to wage war wherever he wanted. He backed Obama's Libyan genocide, and he supports an expanded U.S. role in the Syrian civil war. He even has made noises about allowing the Saudis to come in. But more problematic for the senator is the little-known fact that he himself voted twice in support of regime change in Iraq. In 98, Sanders voted in favor of the Iraq Liberation Act, which said that it was the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power. And then later that year, he also backed a resolution that stated the same thing, that Congress would reaffirm that it should be the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein and promote the emergence of a democratic government to replace him. And these measures gave congressional backing for the CIA's covert plan to overthrow Saddam, as well as the tightening of the economic sanctions regime that may have killed as many as 500,000 Iraqi children. And the resolution also gave the green light to Operation Desert Fox, which you might remember was a four-day-long bombing campaign striking about 100 targets throughout Iraq, and it featured more than 300 bombing sorties and more than 350 ground-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles. And even Hillary belatedly admitted that her Iraq war vote was a mistake, although she did it for purely practical reasons. Morality never plays a role in her considerations. Bernie, however, has never apologized for his two votes endorsing the overthrow of Saddam. And on the rare occasions when Sanders has been confronted about these votes, he has casually dismissed them as being almost unanimous. So you know what I did? I went back and I checked the record. And in fact, many members of the Progressive Caucus in the House, as well as a few libertarian anti-war members of Congress, voted against the Iraq regime change, about 40 of them. You can check it yourself if you look up voting for the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998. So what has changed? Only the party in power. In 98, Clinton was president, right, pursuing his own effort to take down Saddam's government. In fact, in that year, in his State of the Union address, he even laid the political groundwork for Bush's war. And one might recall that over the 8 years of Clinton time, Iraq was bombed an average of once every 4 days. And even though Sanders markets himself as an independent socialist, in fact, he has rarely dissented against Democratic Party orthodoxy in foreign policy, especially when it comes to military intervention. That should permanently settle the notion of whether Bernie is a real Democrat. And with the blood of 500,000 Iraqi children on his hands, surely Sanders has already won the humanitarian warrior seal of approval, which leaves me with only one haunting question, the same question that was given to Madeleine Albright. Was it worth it, Senator Sanders?
Well, she thought it was, and it's amazing that that also Hillary Clinton has found it, she's developed a kind of amnesia about that and accepted, of course, Madeleine Albright's endorsement. But all this, you put together a very comprehensive overview here, showing your cases that Bernie Sanders is not that far outside the circles of the Democratic Party's establishment. So with that said, what do you think ought to happen? What should people do in this election with respect to making a choice, if they were to make a choice?
Well, you know, I think there have been some very sensitive and insightful people who have, because this is a question that you've been continually asking, as you should, over the past month or so. And there have been many thoughtful people who have advanced it, and many who are distraught, as any sane person would be at this quadrennial circus that's going on. Many people have said, well, I'm just going to simply opt out. But that, I think, is a big, big mistake. And anybody who takes that position is not really thinking this through, because that's what they want. That's what the elites want. They don't care if 45% of the people vote. You know, when the 2008 crash occurred, there were emails and telephone calls and telegrams coming into Congress and the White House, 100-1 against bailing out the banksters. And yet they didn't care. They did it. So I think the most important thing is to take a stand somewhere. I would say that wherever there is a good third-party candidate out there, and the only one that I see out there now is the Green Party, but of course they're going to go nowhere because they're being left out of all of the communication culture. And the only way that a real third party can make sense is if it is inclusive, and we need a grand coalition, an interracial coalition of radical groups all around the country. That's what we need, but we're not going to get that. We're already, in February, but the election is only about 7 or 8 months away. So I would say that wherever there is a good, radical, progressive candidate that's running against the corporate parties, people should exercise their franchise and use it. But I think by simply opting out and not voting, you provide great possibilities for the ruling elite to simply do what they want. And so I think there has to be some kind of assertion of negation against this quadrennial circus that's been going on. And I think that, I'm sorry.
No, I said, well, that's you make your case again. The idea is to not just opt out, you say, but to put the vote someplace else. Thanks so much for your call today, Joel, and for your analysis. Let's go to Virginia. Yes. Walt, you're on the air. And welcome.
Yes. Welcome. Thank you, Beatrice. I basically have 2 points I'd like to make. First and foremost, in regards to Hillary Clinton, a lot of the points that your previous callers have been making are absolutely correct. The points that you've been making over the last several weeks are also absolutely correct. But one thing that people who are leaning towards Hillary Clinton, I think, have failed to realize is that aside from all of her political stances with war, with the economy, with the lack of minority involvement until the time of the election, is that the Clintons bring a lot of drama. We can't forget Vince Foster. We can't forget Ron Brown. We can't forget all of the dead bodies that occurred all throughout the political career of Bill Clinton, all the way up to the White House. And with that said, there's so many unanswered questions and still so many suspicions that remained around a lot of those circumstances, that why would we want to go through all of that crazy drama all over again in the White House? Now, you can say whatever you want about Bernie, but the one thing he doesn't bring is a lot of drama. And, you know, that's one thing that I think folks maybe want to take a second look at. The second point I want to make is to your previous caller's point and to what you have been speaking about for actually for the last several months in terms of building a third-party coalition. And I think, you know, we find ourselves, like, right at the footsteps of an election and always saying, well, what about a third party? What about a third party? What about a third party? And we haven't done the groundwork to basically coalesce all of the disparate third-party groups into one unified force where people can channel their money and have a groundswell movement, much like the Occupy movement, particularly with the millennials who are now as populous as the baby boomers in this country, to focus in on one particular entity that is basically that coalition. And I think until we do that and have one focal point where independents can really have sort of a broad tent, but at least a singular point of candidates, we're still going to find ourselves in the same predicament year after year after year after year.
Well, your point is well taken. However, I ask, do you recognize where things are moving now, as fluid as they are, but as part of the process of getting to where you think we ought to be, which is there are signs that people in these different pockets are beginning to organize, and that is part of the process. Is it a matter of patience here, Walt?
No, it's not. Actually, we need to be extremely more aggressive. We need to take the same stance as building a coalition of a third party as the folks in the Black Lives Matter movement are doing in terms of civil disobedience, to basically let it be known that we're no longer going to take this duopoly of these two candidates that are basically, you know, screwing the American people from two different ends. And so until we really do that, until we take to the streets and be really vociferous about those issues in the media, in social media, and keep raising awareness to the point that it becomes almost annoying, sort of like what some people think of the Black Lives Matter movement, then it will never occur, okay? We have to really put our foot on the gas on this and stop just kind of like tapping away at it.
Okay, thank you for your contribution today. Thanks so much. Greg from New York, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, or I guess good afternoon. You know, the biggest reason I'm calling is just to say that I'm a first-time caller and I've been listening for a few months, and I really enjoy this show.
As a
60-year-old white male from New York who never says some of my best friends are black, I guess... I thought you'd get a kick out of that. I've enjoyed, and my wife, a school teacher, is now listening, and she enjoys it. I appreciate you being there. And beyond that, what can I tell you? You want my opinion on something? I'm sorry.
Whatever you wish to say. This is the open forum today.
Absolutely. Well, I will say this. What do we do? What do we do about... I agree with the previous callers. Bernie Sanders has some serious laws, you know, when it comes to empire building, and as Martin Luther King said, how the U.S. has been the largest purveyor of death and destruction in the world. Bernie basically has been signing up for that all along. He has not come out against it, just like Barack has not, and Barack's been for it, and just like Hillary. Having said that, and being somebody who actually got fed up and went out and fought for and won a position in a third party in New York State, and then and made a bit of a difference, I can tell you that I think there's a couple of things here. Number one, people have to get out there and fight. It's the only way it's going to change. The blacks have to get out there and stop supporting the Democrat Party, as you've been saying. And people have to get out there. Instead of being entrepreneurs in the business world, they have to be entrepreneurs in the social change world and get out there and start things and fight and coalesce, because the opportunities are there. You just have to make them happen, especially with the media today. Beyond that, I will say one thing about Mr. Sanders. Yes, he supports vicious, you know, warmongering actions that the U.S. has done over the last 20 years. He has supported them. However, I believe that he is enough of a threat with his ideas that he will not be allowed to win. I don't think the establishment will let him win. And therefore, I am going to support him. I did not support Barack. I did not believe that he would actually bring change. But I will vote for Bernie if it comes down to it. I would not vote for Hillary simply because I want to test the system. This one time, I want to see if the system actually lets him go, because I don't think they will. Because I think if he gets to power, he will change things, and I think the system will not let him have that opportunity. So I want to push it. After that, I'll probably walk away and do something, but not support the duopoly anymore. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Thanks for contributing, and thanks for calling, and welcome. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, Truth, how's it going?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing good, doing good. I wanted to talk about something that you had mentioned on your show Monday in regards to Bill Clinton, referring to Obama as the first mixed-race president and African-American president. Because just to paraphrase what he said, unless you're 100% sub-Saharan African, you can't be African. That's in the same content of what, you know, that he said. And I want to take umbrage to that because, first of all, I am considered what he would consider or what most people would consider a mixed race person, and I hate the term mixed race because I'm not mixed about anything. Okay, my mother is Asian from the Philippines, and my father's African American. So the thing is that I'm not mixed about anything or where I come from. And the thing too is that on my father's side, my great grandfather Henry used to talk to my dad about his mother. My great-great-grandmother, who was named Nancy. And Nancy, as they called her, was a captured slave, Igbo from Nigeria. And so he would refer to my dad as one of his favorite grandchildren because of the fact that out of my dad's siblings, he had the darkest skin. And he always told my dad how much he appreciated his skin color because it reminded him of his mother, who was a captured slave from Nigeria. And so on top of that, I get into arguments with certain black people who don't like to be, you know, considered of the African race because, you know, they always have this argument about, well, we don't know where we're from Africa. Well, you know, it's a trap question. And somebody had asked me that, you know, about like, okay, where are you from Africa? And I gave him my African lineage because I think he was surprised that I knew my exact lineage from Africa. And so, you know, I kind of left them speechless a little bit because it is true that most of us in this country don't really know where we're from because, you know, they took all of our culture and our heritage. But on top of that, going back to what Bill Clinton said, the thing was that we are a mixed, or what he considered a mixed race people, not by choice, because the thing was that our ancestors, majority of our ancestors, was raped by the white slave master. And so it wasn't a fact that we wanted to be mixed. It was just the fact that, you know, under slavery, most of our great-grandmothers had to succumb to the white male slave masters, just like my great-great-grandmother Nancy, who produced my great-grandfather Henry, which is the handle I use when I call your show in regards to him, because of the fact that she still appreciated his African heritage from his mother, which passed down along, you know, in my family line. So the thing was that him saying that, you know, we being a mixed race people and we're supposed to be proud of it is just really, like I said, I take umbrage to that, you know? And yes, yeah, we do have white bloodline in our genealogy, but at the same time, it wasn't by choice. Whereas, like, take for example, my parents, that was a choice. Whereas our great-great-grandmothers, they didn't have a choice on who they were going to mate with. They basically made it with, you know, the slave masters who owned them. And like I said, I really took umbrage with that. It just really made me upset when you mentioned that Bill Clinton had said that.
Did say that. And, you know, it's odd that he should say that. There has been this question about his paternity involving a young man in Arkansas who has long claimed that he is the son of Bill Clinton. He has been made to shut up. And apparently in this go-round with Hillary Clinton's aspirations, he's making himself known again that he is the son of William Jefferson Clinton. You know, this in this case, the President Clinton repeating the same pattern of abuse that you just talked about that Thomas Jefferson did. I continue to remind people that Thomas Jefferson was basically a pederast. He had a young child and had seven children. He had several more, perhaps, according to historians, but certainly with Sally Hemings, he had several children. And we have to factor these things into where we are when we talk about the racial issues in the United States. This is a long-standing history, the history of rape and the history of rape that comes with the history of slavery. This is very, very, very much part of the history of the United States. So I'm waiting to see whether this question about Bill Clinton, the young man is named Danny Williams, and his mother was said to be a prostitute and a coke addicted or a crack addicted person, and Bill Clinton allegedly was a frequent client. So we will see whether this comes up as part of the discussion in this race. And but it's a history that we have had in the United States for a long, long time. But thank you for contributing that and showing us, in a way, the continuing story here, your bloodline, noble as it is, and that you embrace it. Thank you so much for that, Henry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we have Melvin from Chelsea. You're on the air.
Hello, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I like to just mention that you don't really think that the political establishment and the current election is anywhere near the heart of the control of the United States government. Let's try to be real with that.
Okay, I didn't get that.
The political landscape and the campaigning is just a farce. The real individuals who pull the strings of this government and the world are behind the scenes. It's nothing but theater at this current time. You might have, you may not have, or have you discussed this fallout between the Pope's remarks and Donald Trump's rebuttal to his remarks?
No, I haven't, and I'm kind of unwilling too, as a matter of fact. I just don't wish to add any currency at all to Donald Trump.
There's no currency to be added to someone who is a farce. Once you know that there is no credibility to his campaign, as well as to the other candidates, there is no credibility to their campaign, because they're not really running the show. Obama, after Bush and 9/11, and the subsequent presidents afterwards, particularly Bush and Bush the second, they don't really run the country, as we can see. Now we have a situation where we have a very arrogant candidate, Donald Trump, has said some very disparaging remarks on several different groups in the United States. And now he has been on tape and has been recorded saying disparaging things, but hypocritical, of course, to the Vatican, the city of Vatican, to the Pope. There was an altercation, or not an altercation, in a report from the Pope himself. Pope Francis made some remarks that it's not helping for any of the candidates to advocate and promote barriers and walls for any group of people. And of course, he was referring to Donald Trump's comments, but not by name. That called for a firing back, a reply from Donald Trump to make some disparaging remarks. You should try to catch it, because
I know about it. I followed it, and I'm quite
aware. Oh, you know about it. Okay.
I just refuse to talk about it.
I see. Now I understand. Right. This might be a turning point in Vatican, Papal, Catholic, Protestant relationships, because, as you know, Donald Trump is is of a certain denomination in the Christian order, and no one really talks or puts himself in a position of that high echelons of the media and public life against the Pope in such a way. The only occasion I know of publicly was when Sinead O'Connor on Saturday Night Live many years ago ripped up a picture of the Pope as she was performing. And you never heard of Sinead O'Connor again. so I'm just wanting to know if that was something that you are aware of. And also, are you familiar with the Motu Proprio, which was a declaration or a decree from the Pope of resolving or dissolving corporations of the United States and the American Bar Association? People should look for that. I'm so surprised it hasn't been talked about on your radio show. It's called the Motu Proprio. The Pope himself signed it, foreclosing or dissolving, because they believe that he is the one that has some type of papal spiritual power over the world, or the Western world, has resolved the American Bar Association and the International Bar Association and the United States corporations and corporations under the UCCs.
It's a very complicated discussion, and it's a very... We see the Vatican and the Pope usually in a very narrow dimension. We forget that not only is he the head of the Catholic Church, he's also the head of a country. He's a head of state. The Vatican is its own country. It has its own central bank. It has its own, quote, army, unquote. That's symbolic, though it may be, but it certainly has the protection of Italy. It is a vast empire and filled with a really torrid history of serious violence, and one in which you have, the religion, and not just the Catholic religion, but religion as a whole. We have all these contradictions. You see, as you go through, the phases of history, and the Catholic Church certainly isn't even exempt from that. Even popes were murdered and assassinated, and conducted campaigns of war. This is why, we have to be really careful in seeing the Church, any of these major religious orders, as just happening in this little pocket of history. You look at the totality of it. I've stayed away from that, because I know the spark here is the feigned religiosity of the presidential candidates. Suddenly everybody is a person of God. And it's because it's a marketing tool. to tell people, you need not be afraid of me. In fact, you should like me because I fear God. Provided, you know, that we agree God is a Christian God. You know, we have these ridiculous things happening at election time. The little skirmish that occurred there with the Pope offering an opinion as to whether a wall between the United States and Mexico was an appropriate response to the social and political and economic challenges within the United States and Mexico, he said he'd rather people build bridges. He did say also that people espousing certain kinds of attitudes, those attitudes are not Christian attitudes. And I don't know whether people would say, well, he crossed the line. What do you mean crossed the line? The man is the head of a religious entity, and he speaks also as a head of state. So you just take it for what it is and you keep moving. Thanks so much for your call.
But you
know, the role of the church, of churches within the political realm and religiosity and religion within the political realm is really interesting. And I can tell you, if you look at the major religious movements, and from a historical point of view, it's, you wonder how come people with a straight face could claim to be religious, given the history. And we don't see the connection at all with the incredible and untold violence that very often accompanies these religious orders. Thanks so much for your call and for your input today. This is Lead Stories you're listening to, and this is our open forum. It is Free Your Mind Friday, and let's go to the person who actually helped us name this day, Sarah from Dallas. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings to you, Utrecht.
How are you?
I am doing very well. Thank you for asking, Utrecht, and greetings as well as to the listeners and the callers.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. For a minute, I was getting worried. It was all very male-heavy in the calling. I didn't hear any women calling in. I was getting a bit worried that the ladies might be running scared. But you know what, Utrecht? I'm very glad because in this society, men are not allowed to express themselves. So it was very good to hear that the first half was all male callers calling in and expressing themselves as they did. But to free my mind for this Friday in speaking about the electorate and voting, and a couple of your callers expressed my sentiments exactly about not voting. I've been saying this for a long time. I have no intentions on voting because, as you laid out throughout this week in your course that you gave us in civics, because that's something that is sorely missing. A lot of us want to talk about voting, but a lot of us don't have any voter education to know what it is you're voting and how your vote is actually counted up. You laid it out about these superdelegates and how one superdelegate, what did you say that number was? For every one superdelegate, it's the equivalent of how many thousands of regular votes?
More than 10,000.
So you can see right there again the disparity. And one superdelegate is worth these many people. I think the best thing that we can do is to abstain from this nonsense, because technically you don't elect the president of this country. Concentrate on your local levels, because what's happening locally have a more long-lasting effect than what happens in the White House and what happens on the national level. It does not affect you, and we keep thinking that we are a part of this system, that we are helping to run it. When we don't, we in actuality, we are operating under a pseudo-monarchy, whereby they are using elections to let the common folks think that, okay, you are a part of this system, and therefore whatever goes wrong, it's your fault because you went to the polls and you voted and you put these people in office, so therefore you're responsible for it. But we're running a theocratic monarchy. That's what this is. It's the same thing as what these people came from Europe and said they were running away from religious persecution and the kings and the monarchy having dominion over them. It's the same thing was established over here. Because with wealthy land-owning people who are running this country, We only have to look at how this place is set up, the political structure in the legislative branch, the upper and lower houses, as we see with Parliament, the House of Lords, the House of Commons. That's the same thing we have here, the representatives and the Senate. And the majority of these people that are in the Senate, they're all wealthy people. They're business owners, lawyers. The majority of them are lawyers that are running this country. So I really and truly don't know why we think that we are running this government. You know what we can do to crash this system is if everyone would abstain, and you would really and truly show the foundation to show that this stuff is fake. Because if no one votes, then how the heck can you say all of these delegates were given and this president was selected by these delegates and put into office? You're exposing the sham that is the American electoral system. Do not let these people scare you, because everything in this society is ran on fear. Fear Al-Qaeda, fear terrorists, fair police state, fear. All of this stuff is geared on fear. And people, when they operate on the premise of fear, you always work against your best interest. And I am not going to let anybody twist my arm or bully me and tell me that people in the civil rights movement, they march for the vote. No, these people march to be treated as human beings. Vote was a side issue that came about as a result of them wanting to be their humanity to be respected. That was the whole thing that they wanted. They wanted to be respected as a human being, not for no vote. So we let all of these civil rights leaders and charlatans that are running around here and telling black people, miseducating them and misdirecting them and telling them that they have to vote because of all of these marches over the bridges and all of this other, beat down and everything that they suffer for in order to get the vote. No, they didn't do that for the vote. That was a side issue that was thrown in there. So let's at least get educated and work on the local levels where we have things that are affecting us. Like I always say, you have your local district attorneys, you have your sheriffs and all of that. The sheriffs control the jails as well as they control the enforcement of the taxes within your state. Those are people are more powerful. They have to do with your ad valorem taxes and the taxation, your property taxes. That is what we need to be concentrating ourselves on instead of letting them fool you with the Supreme Court. We got to be worried about who's going to put on the court. The Supreme Court don't make laws. All they do is they reinterpret already existing laws and put their spin on it. It has nothing to do with us. So why are we letting them tell us that this presidency is so important because of who's going to be sitting on those courts?
Okay.
It's not important. It's a non-issue.
So you are advocating that people abstain from this presidential election, do not vote, but instead turn their direction to local issues.
Yes, Utrecht, that's what I'm saying, because we have a shorter reach in locally, and what these things affect us, Utrecht, from the taxation, all of our taxes is done on a local level. All of your tax base is locally done. The school system, we're talking about what's going on with the school. We can control the school system locally. All of these things are within our reach. Why are we focusing on a presidential election that is not within our reach? We have no control because you told us with these superdelegates and all these different shenanigans they come up with, within which this presidential election has already been decided, you treat. I've told people that over and over again. It's already been decided. All we are seeing is the roadshow. They're putting on this roadshow to get you engaged, to get you enthused, to scare you up, to get you to the polls. But this stuff has already been done. These people have already been met in a room. They've already been told who's going to be sitting in that office come January of next year. And all they're doing is they're playing their respective roles on this big stage play. All the props are in place.
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling, and thanks for
you're
contributing.
Welcome.
We return to New York. Jose, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor.
Hello,
how are
Jose.
You?
How are you?
The elder's just here trying to free his mind.
Good.
I'm trying to shy away from all this political, garbage, because it is maddening. It is destroying us as a people, because we, as a people, we just don't understand how politics works. You have explained it to us in so many terms, in so many times, but we are not getting it. And so the sister a while ago just mentioned going at the local level and so forth. But I hate to disappoint her because those vassals at the bottom are corrupted and they will continue to be corrupt. No matter who we put in there, they'll be corrupted from the top. So if she thinks that we can deal with these little folks at the bottom and they won't be tainted and corrupted by those at the top, then I have a tooth fairy I would like to interest her in. Now, my professor, I chose to go in a different direction. I'm going to leave politics for a moment, even though everything involves politics. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I went someplace to try and free my mind. And I want to tell you a little bit about it. A couple of weeks ago, I went to this forum in the city, downtown in the Wall Street area, in full view of the African ancestral burial ground, of all places. It was a gathering, a white charitable group or not-for-profit group that sponsors these type of, you know, liberal type of stuff and whatever. So they had two guests, a sister from the continent who has gotten her PhD and other letters behind her name from NYU. There was another sister there from the continent, and she has her name, last name was Buthelezi, which immediately sent me to Gacha Buthelezi. I forgot to ask her if she was related to that sleaze. But anyway, the forum was about sex workers, right? And so I was sent this email, and I said I had to go to this thing because I want to find out what is going on. Just on a whim, prostitutes, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on the air, right? How on a whim you turn a prostitute or a whore into a sex worker? And I said to them at the gathering, maybe it's because I'm an old-timer and I'm coming from a different era in time, right? That maybe my thinkings are blurred and fuzzy, and maybe you all can correct me here. Tell me how you in a new term, you turn that type of activities into a sex workers, and with that you make it dignified. This woman wrote a book on the legalization of sex workers and to how to turn them into decent, respectable people. Just want the right to have to organize and have labor movement and whatever and so forth. And she talked about different countries on the African continent that they are fighting the government to make this legal. And I said to her, I said, you know, maybe it's because when I was a youngster growing up in my native Caribbean island, I remember the days when I saw the American Navy ships and the British Navy ships and Canadian Navy ships and all these ships coming to the harbor. And I would see these unconscious black men at the head of these group of men, taking them, white men, by the way, taking them to these houses of ill repute, which, in other words, is a whole house. That's what they used to call them in those days. And I said they would take these men to these places where the women are symbolically representative of our mothers and sisters and nieces and our neighbors' daughters and so forth. And I could not, as a youngster, understand how a human being's mind, consciousness, could sink to that level, that you'd be involved in that kind of situation. And I go on to tell them that days after those ships would leave the harbor and go off to wherever their destination, people would be going to the clinics to deal with gonorrhea and syphilis and other sexually related diseases. And I said to them, and if HIV/AIDS was around at the time, that would probably be a part of the package of diseases that those white men would come and distribute in, and deposit in our country. And I say, on top of that, about going on 9 months after that down the road, you would see again the results of those men's visit in the birth of children being born in the island without any knowledge of their father and any hopes of any way down the road knowing who their father was. I said to them, these are the things that shape my mind and my consciousness and my morality. Why I am against the legalization of prostitution. And I want to believe that a woman of your stature, your academic background, you would want to take that ad education that you have and try to develop the level of those women, help them to rise up and to stand up and to be the best that they can be. And I said, that is not what an education is supposed to do for you. I said, if you want to get that education and you can't develop and advance your race, your people, what good is that education? And so I asked, they were shouting me down, asking, well, what is the question? So I asked, I said, the question is this. What is in your belief is the reason why a woman, right, is it because of little consciousness or no consciousness at all, or is it the economic factor that would cause a woman to take her precious body and offer it out there to the lowest bidder or highest bidder? And not knowing any kind of low life, you just accept into your sacred body, your sacred parts. And I said, what would make a woman do something like that? And I said, I want you to know that I'm talking about women, but mostly African women, because that is where I'm coming from. An African man, and I'm concerned about where our people are, where they're going, and what is happening to our people. And that is my concern, and that should be your concern also. And so we went on and back and forth and so forth. So the closest she got to answering, responding to my question, was she told the audience that these are the type of men, the voices that is heard back in the past. It is their voices that was always heard and not the voices of the women who want to do whatever it is, want to have the right over their body to do whatever they want to do and so forth. And this is where we are as a people, Utrecht. I want to know if I am someone that is way out. If I'm crazy, if it is just my thinking that alone, and everybody else out there is thinking that everything that is the bachelor's and just, I mean, we must accept everything that is thrown at us. The African continent must be opened up for again the invaders to come in and do what they have been doing for centuries. Only they was getting it, they were doing it for free because they owned our people. But today now, we have these educated among us that is actually again selling our people again. Where are we? I'm a bit befuddled, my professor.
Well, look, this is a very complicated issue because, number one, it spans across all cultures that mm-hmm. have having to deal with this. And the question is the putting the burden on the person who has been forced in their view. This is how they make a living. This is mm-hmm. this is one level of it. The other level of it is, of course, we know that from a historical perspective, it is one of the ways in which conquerors basically express the actuality of conquest. They're able to take literal possession of people.
Yes.
Another aspect of it is that it is not just white men doing this to women of color. It is mm-hmm. black men too. Yeah. And doing basically reaching a point of not understanding what they're doing or not caring about what they're doing. It's also about the state of economic affairs, what people feel they have no choice but to do. When you have a system where people are not getting educated, they don't have employment, they don't have options, many people, this is a viable option because in the end they have to survive. And if this line of work, pardon that pun, but if this line of work is what pays, that's what they will do. In the interest purely of survival, it is in fact a global economy. In fact, that was one of what Cuba was known as. Cuba was known as the whorehouse of the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the things that inspired the Cuban Revolution. People saying, no, we can't have our society, our entire country, basically at the disposal of people to come here and relieve themselves. We have the situation in Korea right now and in Japan dealing with the so-called comfort women who basically were assigned to have, to be at the disposal of soldiers. So, it's a very complicated thing, and it's just no one way to see it. But you raise an interesting point, I must say, because again, in certain societies, this is accompanied. This is a direct outgrowth of conquest, and of being vanquished as a society. And a form of subjugation, and it continues to this day. So it's an interesting question, and I think we should take a look at it at some point because there are so many aspects to it. But I appreciate the agony that you clearly are experiencing over it, and your perspective on it. I see that. But I think we should also look at it from a different perspective too, and that is, how does this fit into the big picture of how people conquer others? How, that arrangement as an outgrowth of the expression of conquest of a country, and therefore the notion that they own everything in it, everything is to be used for a person's pleasure or gain or profit, including people. I mean, we have this going on all over the world, and not just women, children. There's a big economy, a big stock and trade in the sexual abuse of children.
Men too.
It is a huge issue. And I thank you for putting it on the table today. Thanks so much for calling.
Okay, Mike.
That brings us to the end of our program today. I appreciate all of your thoughts and your analyses, and I really appreciate all the more that you offer it with great care and at a very high level of discussion. And I really, really appreciate it. The point, of course, is to build community, and that's what we're trying to do here, giving you the space to express yourselves. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me always at leadstories@gmail.com. It is Friday, so you go into the weekend with a piece of advice, and that is absolutely do not allow any negativity in your life. You don't deserve it, and you shouldn't tolerate it. Until then, take care of yourselves, and we'll see each other Monday. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.